The thought of being alone, that's a very big issue. If you don't know Jewish history, if you know even a little bit of Jewish history, you know we have always been alone, always. And we outlived all our enemies. So what's wrong with being alone? Yes, we're on our own. And the reason is because we are the teachers in the classroom. There's only one teacher, a room full of students. That's how we have to look at the UN. They are not adults. They don't have adult opinions. They don't know right from wrong. They're a classroom waiting to be instructed.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to JTV. We're joined by our regular monthly guest, Rabbi Manus Friedman, joining us from across the ponds just after Purim. Rabbi, thanks so much for making the time to be with us today. So in our last interview, you had various proposals for Israel and suggestions, because a lot of people are kind of, we feel like we're bashing our heads against a brick wall. What do we do with this whole issue with the Palestinians and everything? And you made some very clear propositions. You said that the whole land is Jewish and it should be treated as such. And therefore, there, in terms, you know, you're basically saying one state. And I said, so what about the Arabs living in Judea and Samaria or in Gaza? And you said, well, those who are in any way hostile should be expelled or detained. And presumably those who aren't can live just like anyone else. Now, before I go to responses and reactions that I've had from you saying that, I also want to also say that you said, now, what about the demographic issues? There could be an issue in terms of if you want to be a democracy, it might lose its Jewishness. And you said, well, it should be a Jewish-run country and we're entitled to a home. And there are plenty of non-democracies in the Arab world. And you can still presumably offer plenty of rights to Arabs and non-Jews living in Israel, but it will be, we're allowed to have one Jewish-run home. And you sort of are basically saying, you know, welcome to the region. This is what the region has. You know, countries like Dubai and others, they're not fully democratic and they, in some ways, so why can't Israel be like that? Now, when I've thrown this at people, both religious and non-religious, they've said to me, okay, first of all, Israel's going to be accused of apartheid. Okay, you have one rule for Jewish people, especially being able to run, and then not others.
No, that's... no. They'll never be accused of apartheid. I can't imagine that happening.
Okay, I like this. Let me just finish up the case, and then you can.
Go ahead.
Okay, so then they'll say similarly ethnic cleansing, and then I'm sure you'll respond by saying they'll never be accused of ethnic cleansing, and of course they are. And you're gonna laugh at the final point I'm gonna say, given what's happening in the news. But I wrote, they said this will risk us having total world isolation, and of course. They have total world isolation right now, given the United Nations resolution. But they would say no. But Ollie, this will be 10 times the level. It'll be, you know, America at least is still saying no. We still got Israel's back and all that. And so I've had people saying that on a practical level, it's not going to work. Even if they acknowledge this is potentially reasonable, and even if it's not perfect for them, they're like, "What you? This is. We need to have a Jewish home, and we can't. They know we can't get rid of security control of Judea and Samaria. God forbid." But then, even religious people who Jewish committed. And they agree with these points and they believe it, you know, that this will happen in the future. We'll have a much, but they say, Ollie, these things are so risky to Israel's security that it's clear that until Moshiach comes, we're just going to be in a state of limbo. And our only real duty is just to unite as a people, to do teshuva and all these things. And we have to accept that it's an unsolvable problem until Moshiach comes. So that's what I've had thrown at me, Rabbi. Your response?
It's very weak. Very weak. And it's unnecessary. We have no reason to be so apologetic, so timid, and so intimidated. The thought of being alone, that's a very big issue. If you don't know Jewish history, If you know even a little bit of Jewish history, you know we have always been alone. Always. And we outlived all our enemies. So, what's wrong with being alone? Yes, we're on our own. And the reason is because we are the teachers in the classroom. There's only one teacher, a room full of students. That's how we have to look at the UN. They are not adults. They don't have adult opinions. They don't know right from wrong. They're a classroom waiting to be instructed. We are the teacher. Oh, there's only one teacher. Oh, yeah. There's only one teacher. Two teachers would confuse everybody. There is nothing wrong with our being alone. That's our destiny. That's our mission in the world, to be the one teacher to a very large classroom. So fine, we're alone. We've always been alone from the times of Avraham. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with being the only people who stood at Mount Sinai when God spoke. We were alone in the middle of nowhere. I don't know why we're so afraid to be alone. Secondly, every accusation, every possible condemnation has already been leveled at us. To say if we do that, they're going to hate us is like a traumatized, battered woman. Oh, if I stand up for myself, then they're going to hate me. Well, in the meantime, they've broken your arm, your leg, your skull. Oh, but if I'm strong, they'll hate me. It's not rational thinking. It's a complex that we have. 2,000 years of persecution. We think we're still being persecuted. We have the strongest army in the entire region. We have nuclear weapons. We are a nuclear power, although we deny it. What are we afraid of? Public opinion. That's all. And that is our biggest weakness, and it's making a laughingstock out of us. I think it's time to go with the truth. Simple, unadulterated truth. God gave the land as an inheritance to our grandfather, so it's our land. And no, we can't give it away. It's an inheritance. So no, there is no two-state solution. It's an absurd idea to begin with. That's like the ridiculous laws for divorced couples. The courts in America say, if you get divorced, you have to be best friends. You're not letting us get divorced. No, you have to live in the same neighborhood and you have to raise the children together. Although we might as well be married. It makes no sense. No two-state solution. There never was. It was a childish, ridiculous idea that we invented. The Arabs never thought of a two-state solution. In their mind, there's only one state. And that's their solution. So I think it's time to stop playing this game. Nobody's buying it. It's not getting us anywhere. It's not winning us any points whatsoever. We have never won a single battle in the PR war because we don't speak clearly. Like, for example, when this war is over, please God, very soon, what is Israel going to do with Gaza? Does anybody know? Is it going to be annexed? Is it going to become a Jewish neighborhood? Will it be a new Palestinian Authority? Will it go back to Hamas? Or to Hezbollah? How do you do this? How do you fight a war without a clear goal and ambition? And if you have a clear ambition, state it clearly, unequivocally. What are you going to do with Gaza? Why is there no answer? It makes you sound weak, indecisive. Of course you're going to lose the PR war. It's time to talk clearly. It's our country. We'll do what we want. If you don't like it, there are many countries you can move to. That is not evil. That is not criminal. That's just sane. And people can appreciate that and respect that. They can't respect this, oh, well, we'll see. Well, no, maybe, maybe not. We'll try.
But they won't accept our state. And da-da-da. Yeah.
If you get up in the UN and you say, okay, people, let's put an end to this foolishness. We are the chosen people. We are an eternal people. We stood at Mount Sinai, we heard God speak, and we preserved every word of it against all odds. We know God's morality. You've been trying to make up a morality. The Geneva Conference, the Oslo Accords. You're tripping over yourself. You don't know up from down. You don't know right from wrong. So calm down, sit quietly, and we'll teach you something. It's time. And they will love it because they're so desperate for leadership. And they know it's going to come from Jews. They know it. So let's do it. The one thing we haven't tried is the truth. How embarrassing is that? We've actually lost all faith in the truth. Jews everywhere are sitting around saying, well, we know. They're not going to believe it.
Yeah, and Rabbi, I have people when I say that, you know, maybe we should say, they laugh. They're like, that's ridiculous. You know, so many people either don't believe in God or they're going to think you're a lunatic for bringing in God into the equation.
As if God is not behind all of this in the minds of the Muslims. Every time they hurt a Jew, it proves that their God is on their side and he is the true God.
But they mean when we're talking to the West.
We're not dealing with the West. We're dealing with the Middle East. Yeah. Stop talking to the West. They're not our enemy.
Yeah, yeah. So I totally hear all this, and I agree with you on all counts. But I want to flesh out what people say because they'll say, creating a bit of a straw man potentially, because, you know, you say we've always been alone, but there are some things that by dancing to certain Western tunes at the moment we are maintaining, which could be lost by going through your approach. And then you're potentially, they would say, putting Israel in a very risky and dangerous position. So number one, they would say, you know, America has asked Israel support in partly because that they aren't, you know, yes, there's a lot of people that would call them apartheid ethnic cleansing, but America isn't doing that while Israel dances to their tunes. Similarly, that they are, Israel seems to be very dependent on American military equipment. And you could, if you risk that, then that's also by doing the approach you did, that's also, they would say, potentially very, very risky. I would respond by saying, by not doing anything, it's clearly very risky. But
relying on America is risky. And the proof is you're so terrified that you're going to lose their support.
Yeah.
Just by doing what you need to do, you're going to lose their support? Well, then we don't have their support. We have only a dependency with no return. Because we're still totally insecure about their support. We just find out once and for all. Let's do what we think we should do and see if we have any friends left. It's not a greater risk than what we're risking right now. Now we're risking lives. Not PR, not goodwill. We're risking lives. Soldiers going into buildings that are booby-trapped, dying every single day. Why? Why is the war so old? Wars in the Middle East should end after a week. There's no reason this one didn't. In fact, I don't understand the news. How long has this operation in Shifa Hospital been going on? 10 days? Every day they capture 400 terrorists, 200 terrorists, 700 terrorists. How many are there in this hospital? Why does it take more than a day to empty a hospital? I don't understand it. If we got all the leaders, if we've killed so many of them, why are Jews still dying? Something isn't adding up here. So why don't we try it our way for a change? We'll be safer. And I think we will win the PR war. Just say the truth. Talk straight. Don't mess with people's heads. You're not outsmarting them. You're just annoying.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, because I thought at the start of this war, when you said it's the Middle East and the Jewish, the moral way, even for the Palestinians as well, is to be comprehensive and much quicker in fighting a war. But... you know, and I obviously thought, well, that's definitely going to be a challenging take in the current climate. But then again, I think about the fact that it's been going on now for so many months. And look, I'm not privy to all the details of the IDF, but there's also something very risky and dangerous, as we're seeing, about letting it go on for so long.
Of course.
Because the world's going to get fed up sooner or later.
Oh, it's going to get fed up. The world has been fed up for the last 5 months. After a week of retaliation, the world was fed up. So here's the real cosmic tragedy. We don't believe in the truth. If we got up at the UN and told the truth, they would just laugh at us. Oh, is that what you think of the truth? Is that what you believe? That the truth will make no impression, nobody cares, it doesn't matter? Then what are we left with? The truth is useless. So what do? We outlie. Whoever tells the best lie wins. That's what we're down to? That is a tragedy of cosmic proportion for the whole world. And it's not true. The truth is as powerful as it ever was. And when you tell the truth, people have to submit. They have to. You can't fight the truth. And if you don't believe that, then you don't believe anything. Then keep on lying and c'est la vie.
And how do you, what is the Jewish view in terms of this issue of collective responsibility in Gaza? Because, you know, if you were to go far more comprehensively at the start, obviously there would be in the short term more civilian casualties. Now, we know that there's, Reuters reported, over 80% support for what Hamas did on October 7th in among Palestinian territory, both in Gaza and Judea and Samaria. But, you know, at the end of the day, children especially, they're victims of just being brainwashed and poisoned from birth. Where's the distinction lie there, and how do you deal with those issues?
How ridiculous and absurd when you tell your soldiers, if you enter, let's say, Jenin, because it's a breeding ground for terrorists. If you enter Jenin, be careful not to shoot or harm the civilians. How am I supposed to know who is a civilian? I got to do a family check. I got to vet them. Look them up on Google. How am I supposed to know who in the house that is firing at me, who is the civilian there? To say it's my responsibility to identify a civilian is totally absurd. Nobody does that. Nobody anywhere in the world, because it's suicidal. So you tell me you're not allowed to kill a civilian. Okay, I agree. But don't tell me that I have to identify the civilian. I don't know how Israel has brainwashed its soldiers that it is their responsibility to identify civilians and keep them safe. It's cruel. It's immoral to do that to your own soldiers. And it's not doable. There's no way in the middle of a battle that you can stand there trying to figure out who the civilian is.
Well, by the way, it seems like they've had a level of precision in terms of targeting terrorists to civilians in the history of urban warfare.
At the cost of Jewish lives.
Yes. Yes.
Why is that moral?
I don't think it is.
It's not. So what then is the principle behind it? If a person on the other side from the nation that you are at war with surrenders, then he's a civilian. If he doesn't surrender, how do I know?
So if, for example, when Israel said move to the south, is that an example of civilians identifying themselves?
No. No, it's just enemy people trying to survive.
So what would be an example of civilians?
If they surrendered.
How would they do that?
Come forward and hand yourself over to the mercy of the soldiers. Then I know you're not a combatant. Otherwise, how am I supposed to know? So according to Torah, an enemy who surrenders, you're not allowed to kill. If he doesn't surrender, then he's risking his own life.
And what about, what if, sir, go for it.
That's true of babies too. Obviously, a baby can't identify itself.
Yeah.
But the adults, the parents, whoever's in charge of that baby, needs to identify the baby as a civilian, not as a tool of war. Because they're using babies as a tool of war. Those are not civilians anymore.
What do you say to those who say, well, if they were to surrender, they risk Hamas coming after them, it's a terror society and all that. Would you say that's not Israel's problem?
No, it's not. If you can't surrender when you want to, you've got a serious problem. And I am not going to solve it for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rise up and rebel against the people who are threatening you. and get rid of Hamas yourself? You see, we haven't heard a single call from Gazans or Palestinians. We haven't had a single call to Israel, please help us. No one is asking for our help. So what are we doing? We can't impose. You can't force your help on people.
Right. I heard from someone who claimed to have some insider knowledge that the IDF did have some ability to do, let's say, more comprehensive bombing that could get to the Hamas underground tunnels that would be more comprehensive, more expansive, but that it would affect the surrounding towns of Sderot and others, which is why they didn't do that approach. Did you hear that?
There are all sorts of theories. I think the simplest one of all, as soon as they started the war, you lay siege to the city. That's the old-fashioned way of doing things. Cut off their water, cut off their electricity. In a week, you've got them all. Why not? Why didn't they do that? We're accused of doing that anyway.
I think they did do some of that at the start.
We were accused of it.
They were accused of it. But also, Israel doesn't supply all of these things. I don't think they're the only ones that supply it. So
cut it off. Create a real siege. Don't allow any water. And in a week, it's over.
Apparently, I'm not sure if that we would necessarily bow to this principle, but I think the Geneva Conventions may have some things to say about collective punishment, which this may potentially fall under. I don't know.
Collective punishment is a figment of somebody's imagination. Nowhere in the past and nowhere else in the world does anyone complain about collective punishment. Only in Israel. It's a fiction. Of course, collective punishment. You're at war with a nation, not with an army. It's so obvious, and it's so simple, and it's so true. And we're afraid to say it. Oh, no, it's not collective. Yes, it is. Stop playing games with people. They'll respect you more if you are tough but true. This way we're winning nothing.
But the objective, presumably, is to get rid of the Hamas. You say against war against a nation, like let's say we are against war against Nazi Germany, but that hopefully there will be an ability to rehabilitate and, you know, whatever the word is, to moderate a lot of the populace, presumably, after the war.
Not our job.
Not our job. Yeah.
So we found out there was a much bigger plan October 7th. The plan was that while they were attacking the Song Festival in Re'im and the surrounding neighborhoods, they were also supposed to be attacking Tel Aviv.
How?
Same way. Just go in there and create massacres. And those who were trained to do that were told that they're not going to survive. Tel Aviv is full of soldiers, and they're not going to come back alive. So they recruited suicidal missions. And as they were going to attack Tel Aviv, Hezbollah was going to attack from the north, and it would be a double front.
Yeah.
Why didn't it happen? No one's stopping them. It was an absolute miracle. They were so successful in the areas where they did attack. Why would they hesitate attacking Tel Aviv? So the miracles are just endless, and we're still piddling around with these half-baked concepts like, we have a right to defend ourselves. It's pathetic. So I'm suggesting, as if anybody cares, why is it called the IDF?
We discussed this on the last on our last segment. You object to the name.
It sounds pathetic. We're always defending ourselves. That sounds like a ghetto. Like a shtetl. Not like a country. Countries don't defend themselves. Why are we always on the defensive? We've got to get over this. So, is it radical to say, how about if we try the truth? What a radical idea. You know, when Jews were coming over from Europe after World War II, were coming to America, mass immigration. Every Jew at Ellis Island was trying to decide which lie to tell. Am I older than I really am? Am I younger than I really am? Was I really born in Poland? Was I really from China? Like, what lie do I need to tell now? Because in Europe, you could never tell the truth. Depending on where the front was and where the borders were moving and whether you wanted to get in or you wanted to get out, you had to concoct a lie. So they come to Ellis Island, they say anything. Should I say I'm older or younger? And somebody said, why don't you just tell them how old you are? Really? Can we do that? Yes, you can do that. The war is over. And we're still afraid to do it. Should we tell anybody that we're the chosen people? Or should we keep it a secret so no one will know?
Yeah. So just to wrap up this. Right. Just to wrap up this discussion about just to the issue of war and being uncompromising. So, because a lot of this came down to among religious Jewish friends, just the question of what should be our hishtadlut. And to what extent do we do things that might make sense but are also very risky? So are you saying that we should take, should we take into account at all how the world might react when making decisions and you know, how things might affect Israel's ability to function, exist? How would you define hishtadlus in terms of looking at the natural world and also depending on miracles?
We are not to depend on miracles ever.
Okay.
We're not babies. I know one principle in Jewish life, in Jewish law. If the enemy come and say, give us one Jew of your choice to kill, and we will let you all live. Otherwise, we will kill you all. Do we turn over one person? The answer is absolutely not.
Yeah.
Oh, but then we'll all get killed. You do not sacrifice a Jew. So our responsibility is not an inch. And if you have the power to intimidate the enemy, then certainly you can't turn over one person in order to save the rest. There's no relying on miracles. That's part of our weakness. We're afraid to be proactive. We're too used to hiding in the cellars and in the basements.
Do you think we should have at the back of our mind, though, that at the end of the day, Hashem is with us? You know, and to appreciate that even though it could get really messy, being uncompromising, doing what we need to do, but is that a really critical factor to also know in our heads that God's going to be there?
So again, you read the Torah. How many times does God say, go to war against these people?
Yeah.
Not defend yourself. Go to war. He doesn't say, leave it to me.
Who is the King of Glory, the Lord strong and mighty in battle?
Battling with you, not instead of you. He will give you success. He will give you victory. But if you don't do anything,
right,
you're failing him.
Right. It's so clearly this partnership here. He wants the partnership. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really beautiful when you look at it that way. The other issue that comes up a lot is this issue of land for peace. There's obviously been a massive paradigm shift post October 7th. Thank God that there's been this paradigm shift. But some people have said, well, hold on a sec. You say it doesn't work, but look to what happened with Egypt when we gave away the Sinai. That brought peace. Although others respond by saying, yeah, but that was after a rounding military defeat. And also, I know some people, including I was told the Rebbe, opposed giving away that land. So I wonder if you could just talk for a minute about this principle of land for peace.
There has never been a land for peace, never anywhere. If you give up land, it means you're surrendering. How are you going to get peace from that? You get peace when the enemy has no choice. But if they're dictating, you give me this and we'll give you that, that's not peace. That's a ceasefire. So far with Egypt, we've had a ceasefire. There is no such... I don't know, we use words so recklessly, so irresponsibly. What do you call peace? Egypt has the good sense not to start a war with Israel. That's peace. They're just waiting.
Yeah, exactly.
In fact, when Sadat signed the peace agreement, he was interviewed by Barbara Walters. You got to listen to that interview. He says, yes, we signed peace and everything's good, but if my brothers, the other Arab states, go to war, we're going to have to join. That's after signing the peace treaty.
Wow. That's no peace at all.
In other words, we'll never attack you alone. That's all he said.
Oh, how wonderful.